And welcome to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm Ray Powell, calling in from California. Jim, how are you?
I'm great here in New York, and today we have a guest all the way from across the Pacific in Taiwan right now. But of course, we work with John Hennessy Nyland in Australia. John is a career foreign service officer and currently the professor of practice at Texas A&M, but even more currently a fellow at the National Taiwan University, John?
Correct.
All right, got that right. John had a great career at State, the DCM in Ireland, Hennessy Nyland, you know, that's a natural. He was a foreign policy advisor to MARFOR PAC, Marine Forces Pacific. Then he worked with me and Ray in Australia, where he's political counselor at the embassy. So he's bringing the band back together. And then he ended his career on a great note by becoming ambassador to the island of Palau. So with his career, he's the right person to answer the question, why should Americans care about a bunch of tiny islands strewn across the Pacific, total population of what, maybe 2 million GDP, that's a drop in the bucket. You know, why should we even think about it, John?
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, Ray. It's great to see you guys again. It's been a few years since Canberra. I'm coming to you today, as you mentioned, from Taiwan, of all places. Another key island, one of those many islands that we should care about in the Indo-Pacific. But let me just start with this. You mentioned I'm a professor of practice now at Texas A&M after having retired as the U.S. ambassador. I tell my students and I tell your audience, history matters. I know history may sound dry and dull, but it shouldn't be. If you can remember World War II, you should know how important these little islands are in the Pacific, and some of them are not so small. So I spent my career, about half of my career, focused on this part of the world, which has sometimes been underserved, if I can use that diplomatic term, by the U.S. government. Other people describe it as benign neglect. I think our Australian friends that we love so much, having been in Canberra, say that we're playing catch up. Or if they're not being so polite, they tell us that we're losing, but maybe just a little bit less quickly now in the Pacific, because the attention certainly is on this key region. And it should be. Think about everything you use in your daily life. The phones that we're using right now, the computers, anything with a semiconductor chip. You know what? 90% of them are made here in Taiwan of the most advanced type. So our global economy is dependent on this part of the world. If you think about the region, I'm not the first to say this. President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and many others have said that the future of America will be determined by what happens here in the Indo-Pacific. That's why it matters.
So, John, we want to really zone in for this particular episode on the Pacific Island countries, right? And yep. I will confess to you, when I got to Australia, I really couldn't find most of these places on a map. I mean, I knew about some of them from watching Survivor. I was aware that there was this World War II history that involved a lot of them, but it wasn't sort of, you know, it wasn't really locked in my mind as to why, as an American, it mattered what, you know, what happened in the Solomon Islands, what happened in Vanuatu. I remember just as I was arriving, there was a lot of concern about, you know, potential Chinese bases in this part of the world. But I mean, really when it comes down to it, you know, if as an American, you think, well, okay, but what does it matter to me if there's a, you know, Chinese influence in a little island halfway across the world in a place that I'll probably never go?
A great question. And I'd start with this, you know, using that World War II analogy. Obviously, you know, we want to avoid conflict again, right? Number one job of any government. It's why diplomacy matters here in the Pacific. But the contest, the competition, and sometimes hopefully some cooperation, the front lines for all of this with China, with the People's Republic of China, is in the Pacific Islands. People talk about gray zone activities. Well, here's the incubator. Here's the laboratory where the PRC is experimenting with all sorts of ways and means to try to undermine the rules-based order, which has kept peace and prosperity for all of us, including America, for decades now, since the Bretton Woods agreements and the end of World War II. I'll give you both a micro and a macro example of why it matters, if you want. In Fiji, you mentioned Fiji. I served in Fiji as the political economic chief a few years ago. Well, I'll say a few decades ago now. But you know what? Fiji is a transit point. not just for commerce and shipping, and occasional port calls by the U.S. Navy and others. Just last year, two Chinese nationals who were deported from Hawaii were arrested. Where had they come from? They'd come from Fiji. They went back to Hawaii. And they were charged with being in possession of enough precursors to fentanyl to kill 20, 30 million Americans. So this part of the world matters, even if these islands are small. Strategically, at the macro level, we talked about concerns that we had when we served in Australia. Here in the Pacific Island, the PRC is seeking access, is what we call it. In plain terms, it's facilities, it's bases, it's places. It's a way to break out of the first island chain, to complicate U.S. supply routes. Can you imagine if there is a military base in a place called Papua New Guinea, which at its closest point is just a couple of kilometers from Australia, one of our key allies, one of the Five Eye partners that we share our closest intelligence with, one of the partners in AUKUS, where we are developing the latest technologies to defend America and our partners' futures. China is active in the islands, and the islands are that link point, call it what you want, choke point between America and Asia. And so if we are not careful, if we are not vigilant, we'll wake up one day and see a base, a port that is now run by the PRC. And not just close to the PRC like in Cambodia, but close to some of our key allies, close to even U.S. territory in Guam or Hawaii, one of our 50 states. That's why these small islands matter. And I get it. Trust me. Even when I was appointed ambassador to Palau, I sort of had to quickly study up on Palau. It's tough. It's a faraway region. There's thousands of islands, hundreds of languages. It's a complex place. And each of these small places are remote, difficult to get to, hard sometimes to understand the local politics, let alone the local dialects. So I understand if people sort of go, oh, it's a faraway place, I don't need to care about it. But it really does matter. Let me give you this analogy. These islands are critical parts of that international structure that we've developed since World War II that helps keep the peace and ensure prosperity for all of us, right? That's what we all want to preserve. And yet behind the scenes, in that gray zone we talk about, there are these efforts that are undermining good governance, strong economies, civil society. I liken it to an analogy of termites, you know, whittling away, eating away at the structures of these states, of these foundations. And before you know it, almost when it's too late, these systems could collapse. And if they collapse, it will have an impact on the United States and our future and the future of all of our friends and allies, not just in the Pacific, not just across the Indo-Pacific, but globally. And that is why these small island countries matter. And it's why I, you know, having served 35 years or so in the State Department, I am somewhat critical of our government's role in this part of the world, because we haven't given it the attention it deserves. I fully understand a lot goes on. America follows the shiny object. There are a number of conflicts that require our attention, but we can't drop the ball. We can't take our eye off of this region, because if we do, it's at our peril.
So, John, you were in Palau while we were negotiating a new agreement with Palau and Micronesia and Marshall Islands, which binds these countries to the U.S. to a certain degree. Can you describe what that agreement is and why it matters?
Sure, Jim. Great question. Again, something most Americans probably don't know anything about, but these Compact of Free Association agreements were recently renegotiated. There are two parts to each of these agreements, and there were three different sovereign nations in the northern part of the Pacific in Micronesia. Now, to give you a brief geography lesson, Micronesia is the North Pacific, then you have Melanesia, and further south you have Polynesia. But the issue with the compact agreements is that, as you said, we, the United States, has responsibility for the defense and security of three sovereign countries in the Pacific: Palau, where I served, the Marshall Islands, and the Federated States of Micronesia. Those defense arrangements are in perpetuity. They do not change unless both sides agree to end that. But what does have a time limit, and therefore we had to renegotiate, were the economic and social provisions of each of these agreements. They're not easy to get done. Can you imagine trying to negotiate with a foreign country many, many programs that are domestic? So we support each of these countries in terms of health, education, social services, the whole panoply of domestic U.S. agencies. And so there's a unique element to these three countries. Yes, we're responsible for their security, but they remain sovereign. They have a vote in the United Nations. These talks took time. We had a special negotiator appointed by the president, Ambassador Joseph Yun, who did an admirable job in completing all three. But of course, anything that's agreed to has to be funded by Congress. And there was a delay by Congress of several months, but now all three have been funded. And this is vitally important because it will ensure that we have a stable relationship for the next 20 years with three critical countries in the North Pacific across Micronesia, Palau being one of them where I serve. You know, this is an example, I think, of a positive partnership. We talk a lot about being the partner of choice in the Pacific, right? The compact agreements were the litmus test, if you will, not just for those three countries, but for the region. The region was watching whether the U.S. would follow up on its commitments, whether the U.S. was serious about modernizing and negotiating the next phase of these arrangements. And I think we came through. And I think that's a positive example of what the U.S. can do when it focuses on issues of importance in the Pacific. And certainly for those three countries, COFOR guarantees them, you know, a peaceful, prosperous future. And so I was happy to be part of that when I was ambassador in Palau. But kudos to the team in Washington led by Ambassador Joseph Yun, who did a fantastic job. And I also want to, you know, you don't hear this too often, give a shout out to the U.S. Congress. Though it was delayed, they did manage to get it funded, despite all the politics in D.C. And I think that's another indication why, even in the midst of some political divides back home in the Capitol, both Republicans and Democrats were unified in their understanding of just how important these compact agreements were, because how important the Indo-Pacific region is for all Americans.
So, John, as an ambassador to Palau, you're responsible on one hand to communicate the message that Palau is important because of Palau. But on the other hand, there's the reality that the way that you get the attention from Washington, D.C. or other places is to talk about another much larger country that also has an interest in Palau, right? So on one hand, you're trying to say, look, we care about you because of you, but at the same time, your leverage in this discussion is because, you know, we're concerned about China. How do you balance those two sort of almost seemingly contradictory messages?
Yeah, great question, Ray. It's something, you know, I personally struggle with every day. Let me add a little bit of extra complexity to being the U.S. ambassador in one of these freely associated states that we have a compact agreement with that Jim just asked about. I, as a diplomat, up until my time as ambassador, never managed U.S. Department of Interior funds. You know, that's rather strange for someone coming from the State Department to be managing millions of dollars of assistance that is coming from the Department of Interior. Because as a government, in many ways, we treat these as part of the insular territories of the United States, part of the homeland, if you will. You know, we talk a lot about in the region, in the Pacific Islands, about China, about the People's Republic of China. And obviously, we describe it as a series of seas, right? We cooperate where we can, we compete, and we contest where we must so that we avoid conflict. That's a heck of a lot of seas, right, in terms of what we want to do with the PRC and the Pacific. I simplified it. I'm not a complicated guy. And as you said, you know, I have to focus on my responsibility, which was the Republic of Palau. So at our embassy, we had little cards made up. Our mission statement, if you will, the commander's intent, to use your military term there, Ray. And it was three C's. People can remember three things. One was C was obviously the country you mentioned, China. The second was climate, right? Big, big concern across the Pacific. And the third C was capacity building. Think of infrastructure. Think of the needs of a growing economy. How do we link small remote economies to the global economy? And we worked on all three. That summed up our responsibilities in Palau. The first C, PRC, as we just mentioned, is active. It's not just in Fiji. In Palau, we had a number of criminal enterprises, triads, who are active in Palau. For the longest time, I think local people there and the government considered these sort of activities as victimless crimes in Palau. Most of these triads were running cyber operations, fleecing, you know, Chinese nationals back in the mainland. So there really wasn't any impact perceived in Palau. Problem is, these criminal activities generate a lot of money. They pay off a lot of people. You get corruption, weakened governance, that termite analogy I used before. So we were concerned about the PRC's activities in Palau, not just criminal. And it's hard to say, you know, some of these criminals may have been in Palau because Palau didn't recognize the PRC. Don't forget, I'm in Taiwan right now. Palau is one of the 12 countries that continue to have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, not the PRC. So maybe some of these criminals thought they'd be relatively safe from the long reach of the PRC state by being in Palau. But no doubt, they're also pragmatic. They want to continue to do what they do. And so they occasionally, no doubt, would be co-opted or act as agents of the PRC when necessary in Palau. So we had a lot of concern about that. And no doubt, the PRC would love to flip, as they put it, Palau, and have Palau end its relationship with Taiwan and recognize the PRC. During the last election, when President Soenga Whips was victorious, he was offered what he described as the star in the moons if he were to change recognition to the PRC. So that's China. On climate, wow. You want to talk about an issue that matters to Americans, I would think, and people in the Pacific in particular. It's a life and death issue out here in the Pacific. Climate is a real issue, not just in terms of, you know, rising sea levels or higher temperatures in the seawater. Climate is related to tourism. People go to the Pacific because it's beautiful. It's pristine. Palau makes you sign a pledge when you arrive at the airport, the Palau Pledge, that you will protect the environment. For them, this is one of the few scarce resources that they have, the beautiful Pacific. The last thing, capacity building, and this might interest Jim, I know from his economic background. Infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. If we can be the partner of choice there, we're going to be successful. And you know, ironically, sometimes the PRC's worst enemy is itself. The Belt and Road Initiative, which some of you viewers may already know a little bit about, you know, this intensive investment by the PRC in building things across the Pacific and globally, it's been going on now a number of years. Long enough that people are beginning to see some of the problems associated with the Belt and Road Initiative. Debt trap financing. Some of these facilities are falling apart, like the National Hospital that they renovated in Fiji. The roads, some of the roads that they've built, completely filled with potholes and having to get other people to come and fix them, partners like Japan and Australia. So we focus on infrastructure and being smart about it. So for us in Palau, we focused on three C's. Yes, the PRC, China being one, two being climate, and three being capacity building. That's how we focused on Palau, but also focused on U.S. strategic and national interests at the same time. And you know what? People in the region get it. You know, it's all about partnership. It's not necessarily 50-50. They know that we have our strategic concerns in the region, but they also know that we care about the region when we help them on issues that matter to them too. So whenever we did anything in Palau, I tried to keep those two parts of our challenge in my head, so that there was always a benefit to Palau as well as a benefit to America.
So John, the way it worked was the U.S. sort of took responsibility for working with the island nations of the Northern Pacific. And we sort of left it to Australia and New Zealand to take care of the islands to the Southern Pacific. And now that seems to be changing. I guess two questions. Why do we have to change it? What was it not working? And two, how do you think Australia and New Zealand feel about us pushing into their turf?
Now we're getting into real issues, aren't we, Jim? It's a great question. We all worked on this when we were together in Australia. I should be asking you, Jim, as our boss, how you manage that rather than you ask me.
Right back to you, man.
I'll give it a go, as they say. I did mention that one of our folks that we dealt with in Australia like to point out that Australia's job was to shape us, right? And explain to us the intricacies of the Indo-Pacific and what the U.S. should be doing better. And the idea being that because of our benign neglect, we were losing the region, and that this recent resurgence of interest, podcasts like yours on why the Indo-Pacific matters, means that perhaps we're losing, but less quickly, right? I think the answer is this. We each bring relative strengths, right, to this challenge. It is a complex region. And so in many ways, we can be the partner of choice in certain instances. And in other places, perhaps Australia is better positioned, better suited, more welcome. And let's not forget our partners in New Zealand. And there are differences, as we mentioned already, between Micronesia, Polynesia, and Melanesia. So I think we're all stepping up. Australia, to its credit, is going to have an embassy in every Pacific Island forum nation. That's a lot of places. When I was in Palau, they opened up their first embassy up there in Micronesia, which, as you said, had traditionally been the U.S. patch, whereas Australia had been the sheriff down south, if you want to put it in those crass terms. But sometimes we take slightly different approaches. That's been evident in Papua New Guinea, for example, which is obviously geographically very close to Australia, but also occupies a strategic location globally. And so the U.S. has no global interests. And we work those out. I'll give you an example. In Palau, and it's also the same in Papua New Guinea, we all care about the maritime domain, to use one of the military term. But essentially, we like to be able to partner with countries to know what's going on in their water, right? Makes sense. Not just from a military perspective, but just security, environment, and all the ways of thinking about the value of this water that surrounds these islands. So we do our bit in terms of staffing up fusion cells of information that's partnered with Australia and New Zealand. Australia has a boat program where they donate a small patrol vessel that operates in coastal waters to each of these Pacific Island Forum nations. We work with the Japanese Coast Guard who do something similar. We're putting more and more U.S. Coast Guard assets into the region. We have ship rider agreements. These are agreements where we put U.S. Coast Guard officials on patrol vessels from Papua New Guinea or Fiji or Palau, and we can help enforce their regulations within the economic zone of these countries that extend out 200 miles. So we are all playing to our strengths. I think we're cooperating more than ever, and that collaboration is important. You see it in AUKUS at the highest level, but you also see it very much in the Pacific Islands, too, where the U.S. and Australia and even our European partners are doing much more now. Including the UK, France, and others. And I'd also like to mention that other countries are also active helping Pacific Islands. I mentioned I'm in Taiwan. Taiwan, unofficially and officially, does a lot in the region, as does Japan. Korea is also stepping up. So this is a team effort. And sure, sometimes teammates have differences of view. You mentioned Australia and New Zealand. But we work them out because we have such a close relationship.
So, John, one of the terms that gets a lot of attention when you talk about smaller nations and island nations is the term elite capture, and how China uses elite capture to compete with us in these places. What is elite capture, and how does it differ from the U.S. approach, and what are its strengths and weaknesses?
Ray, elite capture is just a fancy term for corruption. little red bags of money that are passed to politicians at dinners and receptions and national days. We should call it what it is. Elite capture sounds something academic, you know, something that perhaps people don't understand. Well, you know what? It's corruption. And I think anyone can understand that. You know, Chinese are using their influence, their money, to buy off politicians across the Pacific. They're using money to try to influence elections across the Pacific. This idea of elite capture is particularly problematic in the Pacific, because think about it. These places are small. Palau has less than 20,000 people, for example. You know, parliament is maybe 50 people. If you can swing a couple of people through elite capture, you can change the direction of that country. You saw it in Fiji. Fiji's had a history of political instability. You know, it doesn't take a lot. A few guys and a few guns can take over parliament in these Pacific islands. And so there is a real challenge there. We do not play that game. The PRC does not play by the rules. And elite capture is a real risk. You know, even in these democratic nations of the Pacific, whenever there's an election, you know, it's a concerning time, because, how should I put it? A little bit of money goes a long way in the islands. And there's real concerns about, you know, these activities that weaken good governance and the structures of government. And let's be frank, corruption takes place in every country, including our own in the United States. But when you have a small population and an even smaller group of elected officials or influential officials, and don't forget, in the Pacific, it's not just the elected officials. You're talking religious leaders. You're talking chiefs and clans and clan leaders. You know, it only takes a small amount of people at the very top to completely change direction for a country. And these countries, as we said, matter to the United States.
You know, what the Australians have been trying to do is emphasize their ties, cultural ties, sports ties, rugby bad.
Yep.
Australians and Islanders, church, the importance of religion in these islands. And so try and say, look, we're all part of this Pacific family. How does that go down in the years of the Pacific Islanders?
You know, I think there is a value to what, you know, to use an academic term again, Ray, soft power, right? Heck, at Texas A&M, I teach a course on sports and diplomacy. I'm working with ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, on the possibility of having a conversation, you know, around the Cava Bowl, you know, in the Pacific way, about using sport to connect people, right? I think there's a real value to it. You know, I think you can take it too far. As I said, the one mistake I think sometimes people make about the Pacific Islands is that they're not sophisticated. Heck, that's completely wrong. You know, they get it. They've been dealing with Australians and Kiwis and Americans and others for centuries. They sometimes understand us better than we understand ourselves, and so they know what the intent is. But I think anything that's sincere about building bridges and using soft power is appreciated. Let me give you another example about this hybrid approach that the U.S. has in Palau, and unfortunately, it's only in Palau, whereas these groups used to be across the Pacific. I'm talking about civic action teams, affectionately known as the CATs, right? They used to be everywhere across the Pacific following World War II. These are civil engineers, if you will, that come from the military, but they're full-time present in these island nations. In Palau, we have a tri-service rotation of engineers from our military, from the Air Force, Navy, and Army. Unfortunately, no Marines participate in that, but Marines do other things in Palau. And they're known as the CAT team. They've been there longer than the U.S. Embassy. They're better loved than the U.S. Embassy, I have to be honest, because they do things that people can see. They fix roofs. They repair roads. They build playgrounds. They fix basketball hoops. They do small engineering, small infrastructure projects that matter. And they're there all the time. And that is the type of soft power that works. Yes, they're from our military. The military has more resources than state or the civilian agencies. And yet they're playing a critical role in that relationship between Palau and the United States. They're playing a vital role in the people-to-people diplomacy that we talk about that matters so much in the Pacific. So we're doing our bit. I wish there were more cats around the Pacific. I think they're probably one of the best investments we have in the Pacific. But I know from personal experience as the ambassador in Palau that they do a fantastic job. So soft power, I think, matters. It's all about partnership, right? And you know, Secretary Mattis has said this and others, you can't surge trust. And so it takes time in the Pacific to build these relationships and to have presence and permanence. And that's where the U.S. has had a problem. You know, I was fortunate enough to serve at one of our few posts in the Pacific. We're trying to open more in the future, but we're playing catch-up. We haven't been there. Pulled the Peace Corps out and put them in other places. Only now is the Peace Corps returning to the Pacific. So any opportunity to reconnect via sport or international exchanges, bringing students both ways, or things like civic action teams, they matter. The low cost, high impact, which is really what we need in the Pacific.
Well, John, we're coming up on time, so I want to get you out of there here on an exit question. What is a state cable, and what is the role of Charlie Brown cartoons in state cables?
Well, you know, state cables are a unique way to communicate from experts in the field to people back in the department who may not fully understand, you know, what is going on in a particular country. So I sometimes think using cartoons, everyone can understand a cartoon, is a great way to explain something that's complex.
How was that philosophy received at U.S. Embassy Australia?
I think at U.S. Embassy Australia, it was well received. The better question is, how was it received back in D.C.? And I'll leave that to others to judge.
Good grief, Hennessy Island.
So the inside joke there was that John tried to slip in a, I believe it was Lucy and the Football cartoon into one of our state cables. I don't think it actually survived the editorial process, however.
No, Jim may have had a vote on that, but it's the notion of people moving the goalposts, you know, and there's a great cartoon, Peanuts cartoon, just about that issue.
Well, I'm a military guy, so I like pictures. So I was definitely in favor. All right. Well, John Hennessy Island, it was good to see you again. It was great. What are you putting on your head there?
I have a hat for you all that I have specifically for this podcast. And I don't know if you can read it, but it says Diplomacy Matters.
I'll explain it to you later, Ray.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, all right. Yes, diplomacy matters almost as much as an aircraft carrier. It's been great fun to have you. It's great to see you again. Enjoy Taiwan. I understand you just came from a pretty exciting event there with the inauguration.
Yeah, it was a fantastic event. Very, very happy to be here. I'm here all summer on a fellowship from the government of Taiwan. So honored to be here.
Well, it's been an honor to have you, and it's great to see you again, John.
Great to see you guys. Take care.
So, Jim, it's great to see John again. I think maybe we just ought to talk for a minute, though, about, you know, just getting kind of go from little to big and say, why is it that people worry about this part of the world that, frankly, most people really don't, you know, aren't very familiar with? And as you were chargé in Australia for 2.5 years, and I know that the Australians are like really, really intensely focused on the South Pacific and the problems there. Why did they worry about it so much?
Well, I think, you know, John alluded to World War II and what it meant, but think what it means if you have all these islands between the U.S. mainland and Australia, and you can block the passage of supply ships to and from the United States and Australia. And that's what these islands can do. And that's why the Japanese used these islands as jumping off points for the eventual invasion of Australia, or at least the blockade of Australia, and why we fought back by taking these islands one after the other. So the islands in and of themselves, economically, there are no economies. You know, John talked about tourism. They have large fishing areas. But basically, they're never going to have enough of an economy to really support themselves without outside help. That's one. to, you know, no matter how big your population is, you need infrastructure, you need electricity, and you need communications. And if that cost is spread around only, like in Palau, 20,000 people, that's a really expensive proposition to do without outside help. So you have an important geographic area with an economic base that really isn't sustainable. So we're competing with China to have enough influence to give them what they need so that they, at a minimum, stay independent of Chinese efforts to establish any sort of military political control.
Yeah, I remember when I first arrived in Australia in 2017, one of the issues that was on the table at that very moment was the potential of having a base, a Chinese base in Vanuatu. And so, and it seemed like for as long as we were there, it was the idea of a base here or here or here was just constantly in the news. And then, you know, of course, as you sort of go up into sort of those COFA states and other places that are closer to say Guam and then eventually Hawaii, then the problem gets, you know, from a military perspective, gets more and more and more real.
Well, and let's not forget, China's building a blue water navy, and they're building it at the fastest pace in history. So we are no longer sailing the ocean blue by ourselves. They even now have peer competitors out there. And you need bases or places to supply and land. And that's what these islands are from a military perspective, if I'm not incorrect. But that's what they taught me at Indo-PACOM.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, if you look at the entire sort of theory of the case these days coming from the U.S. Air Force, the idea is the big bases that we used to rely on, you know, place big, huge places like, you know, the one that used to be at Clark Air Base in the Philippines, or the one that's still in Okinawa at Kadena Air Base, or the one up at Yokota Air Base in Japan. These big bases, now you could do the same thing with the Navy or the Army or the Marines, are also big targets. And they're big targets that are very close to where China has its land-based missiles. So in a 21st century war with precision-guided munitions and sort of, you know, the idea that there's no place that's really that safe anymore, we need to be able to be very agile. And so the term in the Air Force is agile combat employment, where if you can't land back at the base that you came from, you need to have a bunch of different options at other places you can not just land, but repair, refit, rearm, you know, all the rest of these things that you have to be able to do. So, you know, you want to complicate, one of the ways that you deter a war is to complicate the strategic problem of your potential adversary, right? So you don't want it to be too easy a problem for them to solve. You want them to have to think about it. So lots of different access points. And in the Pacific, you know, all of those islands are potential access points. And by the way, all of that works in reverse. So now all of a sudden, if China has access to all of those access points, you know, do they then feel more emboldened to maybe risk going into an actual conflict? And that's, you know, obviously, ultimately, that's what we're trying to deter.
Yeah. Well, historically, after World War II, we took a sort of paternalistic approach to the Northern Pacific Islands, as John referred to, the Compact of Free Association. So these countries basically can become members of our armed forces. And many of them do. In fact, they join up at a higher rate than American Americans do. And they're great. And they bring back money to their home islands that way. We help take care of their defense and send in medical teams and all that sort of stuff. But that said, these are proud, independent countries who, if we don't follow through with our agreement to support them, they're going to look elsewhere. And that's why I was... very difficult getting these negotiations over the line and making sure it was done with respect to our negotiating partners, regardless of their size.
Well, Jim, I mean, you know, this is one of those things most Americans, frankly, and I, you know, I'm no exception up until I got posted to Australia, don't think a ton about those islands, those Pacific islands. But I think the reality is that a pretty small investment can make a pretty big difference in a lot of these places. And that's true for us, but it's also true for our competitors. And absolutely, if we end up just sort of shortchanging them because they're small and out of the way, you know, somebody else is going to fill that void. And I think we know who that is. But Jim, we are coming up on time, and I think I owe you a story. And so I thought that in this week's version or edition of There I Was, I would complete the story that I started in our pilot episode, which was, if you recall, we had had a terrible mishap off of the coast of Australia very soon after my arrival. And we had managed to get everybody, you know, there were three Marines who had perished off the coast, and we'd managed to get, there was a dive ship that went out, an Australian dive ship that went out to retrieve them. And the good news, from that terrible situation was that we were able, the Aussies were able to help us get our Marines back up to the surface. The complication, if you'll recall, because you were very involved in this, was that it turns out that the coroner in Queensland, Australia, has an awful lot of power. And it was in his mind that he needed to do autopsies on those three Marines. Now, we were not interested in that at all. There was no secret.
It was useless.
There was no secret as to how they had died. And, we wanted to get them back to their families as soon as possible. And we couldn't understand why this particular, official just had it. This was the one thing that he had to be able to do. And so we were, the good news was that we had in Australia a JAG. We had a Judge Advocate General. We had a lawyer who worked there in the embassy and went and grabbed him and said, "You have got to help. You have got to help us find something that says that we can get out of this." And so he had his entire staff dive into the Status of Forces Agreement. And it turns out that, glory be, somebody had actually foreseen this. And there was something in there specifically written that said the Attorney General of Australia can essentially tell the coroner of Queensland to go pound sand. That, in this particular case, the interest of the nation superseded his authority. And it turns out that was like the only thing that would, because nothing else seemed to work. So I distinctly remember this, standing up in your office with the JAG on the phone, talking to the Attorney General of Australia, explaining exactly what he needed to put into his email to send to the coroner of Queensland, as you and I are sitting there winking at each other, thinking, thank goodness we got out of this one.
It was an exciting day, but the Attorney General was a good guy about the whole thing, probably helped by the fact that the Queensland government was from the other party.
Yeah. As I understand it, nobody particularly was a big fan of the coroner there. He seemed to be on a little bit of a power trip. So
I think so.
Although if he's listening to this podcast now, I'm sure he's a swell fella.
No comment, Ray.
All right. A good bloke. All right. Well, Jim, it's been another great episode. I want to thank you for joining me. I want to thank Ian, as always, for being an excellent producer. I want to thank our guest, John Hennessy Nyland, former ambassador to Palau. And I want to thank our audience who continues to subscribe to our podcast, who continues to go to our YouTube page and watch. We've got some great episodes coming up. So for Jim and Ian, this is Ray. Thanks for listening.